And we are live, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another episode of the Project Egg Show. I'm your host, Ben Gothard, and today we have the honor of speaking with Mr. Peter Montoya. How are you doing today, Peter?
Great, Ben. Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. I'm so glad and excited to chat with you today because I really want to ask you, what is your story?
I've had a long, challenged story. Grew up in Pasadena, was the oldest of five boys, John, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Were raised Catholic, went to school at the University of California, Irvine, and graduated with a degree in political science. My mother really wanted me to be a politician. I just didn't have the ambition or sex drive for politics. So with a degree in political science, you've only got a couple of choices, and that is law school, food services, you can become a bartender or a waiter, or sales. And I went to work for the biggest motivational speaker in the world straight out of college. I was in sales, traveling around the country for 3 or 4 years, and learned how to become a speaker, largely in sales and motivation. Then moved on to marketing and branding. I wrote several books around personal branding. The best known one was The Brand Called You. Started an advertising agency specializing in marketing and branding for financial service professionals, and then transformed it into a software company, and then sold that in 2018. And now I am pursuing my purpose, which is to help people transform while building better community and hopefully making a positive impact on the planet.
So how did you discover that that was your purpose?
I think I've always been drawn to it. I think that I've always gotten, ever since I first got involved with personal development when I was 18 years old, I really got excited by seeing people transform. Of course, being a person transformation, and then being around people who are transforming and then later leading people through personal transformation has always been a real thrill for me. But transformation by itself is kind of worthless unless you're actually doing something with it. So unless you're improving your life, the lives of the people around you, and or humanity, it's kind of a waste of money.
So transformation just for the sake of transformation, not enough?
Probably not. Not considering the challenges that we as a species are facing right now. We really just don't have the time to just kind of be in and just kind of be right now.
So it's like, it's more of like a survival, like a biological imperative to survive more than like a moral or ethical responsibility.
Well, I think you probably could say that. I would say, all right, we have a moral imperative to survive, to make sure that we're leaving a planet onto our children, which is at least as good or better than we found it. And I think that we're probably headed on a path not to do that right now. So I don't really think we have the luxury as a species right now to just kind of navel gaze and contemplate our existence. We don't have that luxury right now.
So what does that transformation actually look like? Or what has it looked like for you specifically? I mean, did you just read a lot of books? Did you ask yourself hard questions? Did you journal? Did you do, you know, what did that process actually look like for you?
Oh, that's a great question, Ben. So, you know, as I mentioned, I went through my first personal development course when I was 18 years old, and I absolutely hated it. I mean, I sat in the back of the room, grinding my teeth, having a in-head argument with the facilitator every single step of the way. I resisted it completely. And it wasn't until about a year later that I finally reduced my anger enough that I was reflecting upon it, that I realized that there was some pretty good stuff in that course. So I went back and read the course again, this time with an open mind, which is pretty critical if you actually want to grow and learn. And then I kind of began my journey. And since then, I've attended at least one, if not two, personal or professional development courses every single year for the last 30 years. And it has transformed my life, and I'd like to think the lives of the people who are around me as well. In addition to that, I'm an avid reader, and I've become a complete and total podcast junkie. I think the podcasts in the last 2 years of my life have given me a second bachelor's degree. Just by listening to podcasts every single day for a couple hours. So I'm a huge fan of the podcast medium. I journal a lot. I'm also a fairly deep thinker. I think about the hard questions on a regular basis. So I think my life is undergirded by a philosophy and a practice of personal development.
Well, first of all, rock on with the podcasts. Hell yeah, that's what I'm talking about. I love podcasts, obviously. So it's I love when other people have that same passion for podcasts, because so many people put in so much time and effort into creating incredible content. Mm-hmm. And actually, most of it goes unnoticed. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, I love to hear that fellow podcasters and fellow lovers of podcasting are out there, and I love talking to them.
I couldn't agree more, because they're putting incredible efforts into the content. And number two, it's free by and large. They're starting to charge now for ads and find different ways to monetize podcasts, but it's by and large still free. And the third, you know, there's an amazing intimacy between a podcast host guest and the receiver. So as someone's listening to this, in their car, I listen to a lot in bed as I'm going to sleep. There is a connection unlike any other medium, because it almost feels like those voices are inside your head. So it's very, very intimate. And to me, it helps me learn faster than maybe any other modality.
That's amazing. Is it the conversation that really sticks with you, or like what about the actual podcast is so helpful for your learning?
So I listen to all types of formats of podcasts. I love conversations like the one that Ezra Klein and Sam Harris and Joe Rogan have. They're amazing conversationalists, and you can tease out some wonderful information. I also like call-in shows. I even like some call-in shows where the hosts argue with the guests. I learn logic that way. And then I also love the documentary style, the drama style. So any of those formats can work really well for transferring information. Malcolm Gladwell's podcast is mind-blowingly good. It is written so incredibly well. If you're not listening to Revisionist History, go pick that one up right away. It is absolutely a gem. And even if you don't like the content, just to hear how he puts them together, how he weaves together a story, is absolutely masterful.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with it, because putting together that story and making it both entertaining, but also giving people something that they can take away from it, that is truly a work of art. I mean, I really feel like a lot of podcasts are artists first and foremost, mm-hmm. and podcasting is just their medium. So I'm curious, as you're reading and you're going to these courses and conferences and listening to podcasts and whatnot, how do you retain all the information? Because I know personally, I read constantly. I mean, I read for hours every single day. And one of the biggest struggles that I have is actually retaining everything that I read. And it got to the point where I even started like a podcast that I don't market at all. I don't do anything with it, just to challenge myself to be able to teach some of the key lessons from the books that I read, just to make sure I'm absolutely comprehending as much as I possibly can. So how do you actually go about retaining all that information?
Ben, you just asked a million-dollar question. I'm going to give you probably the best idea you have gotten from any podcast that you've personally done in the last year. So
that's a high bar, my friend.
I tell you, this is really, really a good idea. So I use Google Sheets, but you also could use Excel. And in Google Sheet, I have a folder called Peter Content Development. And in here, in this sheet, I put all of the ideas that I hear and I read on a regular basis. So every single day, I am in this massive Google Sheet. There are different tabs. I think I've got 10 different tabs through here. And each tab is a different category of content. So one tab is called articles. And whenever I read an article that's really helpful and useful, I will go and put that article actually in this tab. It has the date, the topic, the type, the headline, and the link. I have another one called podcasts. And when I'm listening to a podcast, that's a really good idea, I put it in there. The date I added it, the topic, the title, I put the link, and also I'll put in there the timestamp for whatever it might be and the notes. I've got other tabs for my personal stories. I'm a speaker and trainer. So every single day I'm trying to develop a new story that I can tell. Whatever, you know, you might be out to the grocery store, you might get cut off, you might have a phone call with a family or family or friend, and you have those aha moments. I put those stories in there. I have quotes that I like. I have competitors that I want to keep an eye on. I have the personal development exercises that I like in there. So I'm constantly developing this massive spreadsheet with different tabs that helps me categorize all the content I want. So whenever I'm working on a book or working on a speech, sometimes I have a memory and inkling of what I might need, or I can just go through and look at the topics or the headlines and find the content that I sourced.
So you're basically going through, and as you are downloading this information, whatever happens to be, you know, significant enough to really stick out, then you document it into this spreadsheet with time, date, link, timestamps, et cetera, and a note on like what it actually is, right?
Yeah.
That's cool. I really like that.
It was a $1 million idea. I told you it was the best idea you got all year. The high bar.
So when you're like, let's say you're reading a book, right? And let's say it's just a gem. I mean, an absolute gem of a book. Will you write multiple notes for that one book?
Yeah, absolutely. So a lot of times I'll use the noting feature in Amazon, and I'll usually create little blurbs about it in the books tab, and then link back to those notes in the book. Sometimes I'll take a picture of it of the book, and then actually you can put pictures back into the sheet. So there's all sorts of little techniques to do that.
That's awesome. So you're building like a virtual representation of what you believe and hold to be true, and like the ideas that you most like these are the ideas of other people that you really enjoyed and have liked.
Yeah. So more or less what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to pursue the best explanation for reality. So I'm trying to understand reality as best I possibly can. I am studying what's called nature, and I'm creating a document that helps me understand it. What I'm looking for, which I think is what most people are looking for, is I want to create predictable models. So I want to create a model so I know if I do X and Y and Z, then I'm going to get the result that I want as often as possible, which is really hard because the world's getting increasingly more complicated. But yeah, almost anything you want to do, someone out there already has created a predictable model to help you achieve it.
So why is it so important? And it may be obvious to you, but I have an inkling of what the answer might be, but I just want to ask you directly, why is it so important for you to want to understand reality? Like, why is that the core of like what you're going about trying to do?
So let me, I'll take one step back and broaden it a little bit. And we'll talk a little bit about morality, which is kind of a heavy topic for most people. So I believe that the goal of morality is subjective. It's up for each person to decide what morality is, what is right and wrong. So some people might say that their morality comes from God or the Bible. They might say, if God says it's okay, then it's good. And if he says it's bad, well, then it's wrong. Some people might create their morality around the Constitution. So they might say, if it's legal in the Constitution, according to the government, then that is good. And if it's illegal, then it's bad. And my morality comes around the Constitution. Some people may have their own internal moral compass. And they might say, well, you know, I just want to be a really nice person. And that's a little nebulous, but they just believe, you know, if it feels good and it's helpful to others, kind of the golden rule, well, then that's moral or immoral. And for me, I've thought a lot about it. And I really think that my morality is tethered to human fulfillment. So I really believe that I want to live a fulfilling life and flourish as much as possible without hindering or hurting anyone else. That's the decision that I have made. And in order to live a fulfilling life and make sure the people who are around me live a fulfilling life, it's really complicated. It's very complicated because there's about 99% of the world which you should not be paying attention to. Only that 1% of the world we should. But all these things are being put in front of our faces on a daily basis, which feel good in the moment, whether it be watching too much TV or social media or adult films or gambling or too much drinking, too much alcohol or bad food. There's all sorts of things that are tempted in front of us. And there's only a few, really a few basic things we should be doing to be living a fulfilling life. So the reason I spent so much time on that is to help me distill what are the things we should be focusing on to live a fulfilling life.
And based upon your journey thus far, what have you discovered are those things?
There are, so I run now a real world community and life school completely dedicated to human well-being. So we've looked at the school of longevity. So there's a lot of people around the world who are actually researching longevity, which means how do you live a longer, happier, more fulfilling life? Ones of note are the Blue Zone study, and then also the Harvard study of longevity, which has been going on for 80 years. That's one place we've looked. The other place we've looked is toward positive psychology. Victor Maslow started that back with man's search for meaning in the 1950s. And from that, there's actually now a school of psychology, which basically says, how do we live happier, healthier? And there's a lot of overlap between longevity and positive psychology. So we've identified a number of practices based on those two schools and based on scientific research on how to live a more fulfilling life. So here are some of them. Now, most of them people know. The problem isn't knowing them. The problem is doing them. So here are some of them. The first one is living a life of purpose. And that is doing something that is not only satisfying to you, but is actually meaningful to society. So what is the role we can actually fulfill to society on a regular basis? I was just listening to your podcast with Zach, and he was kind of nibbling around the edges around this concept of purpose. Like, what was he doing? And it wasn't until he found his podcast that he found his purpose, for example. Another one is belonging. We are tribal beings. Every single mammal on the planet is a social creature. Well, except the honey badger. The honey badger clearly does not care, but the rest of us mammals are social creatures, and we need people. We need other of our same mammals. And what has happened because of our modern society, we've kind of have built our own little fiefdoms, our own little castles, which are isolated from everybody else. We have these mobile isolation chambers called cars, which keep us apart from anyone else. And then we have these technology devices. Technology is at its worst when it's keeping us from having meaningful conversation with the person sitting next to us. And it's at its best when it helps us connect. But more or less, our houses, cars, and technology are doing a terrible job of helping us connect to fellow human beings. And people are suffering from what I call isolation sickness, where they actually get so lonely, they believe they don't need people anymore, and they have incredible anxiety whenever they go into social situations. So we need belonging. We need to have a tribe where we go, these are my people, I belong here. We also need calm, which is meditation. Meditation, for very good reasons, is making a massive upswing in our society. So we believe in meditation too. And it's not just meditation. It also is a decision away from anger. So, you know, when I was younger, I used to kind of revel in my anger. I would get stressed and mad at a driver, and I would curse and vent. Now I don't do that. I really believe what gets fired gets wired. So if you're constantly firing those angry emotions and angry physicalities, that's getting wired in you, and it's really bad for your health to have high anxiety. So calm is about making decisions to lower anxiety, which includes how you handle anger, stress, and also meditation. We also believe in sleep, and sleep has been the enemy for most people for decades. So we also teach healthy practices around sleep. Diet is critically important. There's about a million different diets out there. They all contradict, except on one key fact, and that is sugar is really, really bad for us. So keeping away from processed food and sugars is kind of the core of our, we have a very, very broad diet plan, which is increase lean meats, fruits, vegetables, seeds and nuts. That's increase those as much as you possibly can and decrease processed food. So we're fairly broad on that because there's so much disagreement on the best diet plans out there. And we also believe in empowerment. And in societies around the world, they don't have to worry about empowerment, but here in the United States, we do. Empowerment is living a life by your own design. And unless you are somewhat trained and strategically making decisions about your life, you are living somebody else's plan or living by accident, which is usually not too healthy. So those are the practices that we teach as a way to living a more fulfilling life.
So how do you then tie them all together in and implement them all? Because just because we know them, that's not good enough. I mean, based on my opinion, I believe we have to actually implement those things.
Yeah, you're right. So for us, what we've discovered, the best way to do that is in peer groups. So you have accountability among peers. So, everything we do is voluntary. And so when we get new students together and groups together, they basically describe their life as they want to be. They describe the things they actually want to take on right then. And we don't make them do all 8 practices right away. We may have them focus on 3 practices. We get them up with accountability buddies, and then they go to work. But everything is done by choice and agreement. And I think probably one of the best things we've learned from the School of Behavioral Economics is creating consequences for yourself when you don't live by your practices. So, I've got a practice every day where I meditate for at least 5 minutes. That's my minimum. And I rather be going for 15 minutes or a half hour. And when I don't do that, I've got a painful consequence for me. I have to make a donation to a politician I really dislike. So I've only missed that one day, and I had to go online and send $10 and then receive his emails on a regular basis. And knowing that I have my name associated with that politician causes me a great deal of pain. So I don't want to do that again. So we like to have people create their own consequences. No one's putting a consequence on anybody to motivate them, make sure they're doing the practices that are most important to them. And then pairing them up with the buddies is a little bit fun.
So when did you actually hammer down these 8 and you're like, all right, these are the 8. This is it. No more, no less. These are the ones.
Great question. We probably did that over the last 4 years. I've got a really good research team. There's been so much great data just in the last 4 years coming out on both longevity and positive psychology. It wasn't hard to find between the two schools the overlapping ones that made most sense for our society. The only one that's not in their book that we had to put in there was empowerment. Our society, it's an aggressive society. And unless you are fending and taking care of yourself, the state, the government doesn't do a very good job of that. So in many other cultures around the world, empowerment is just not an issue. And that was the one we really had to tie in for our Western world.
So is the idea that we want specifically with empowerment, because it seems like that is like y'all, it seems like you curated the 7 and those were kind of the overlap from the research. And then the empowerment was, no, this is so important to us. We have to put it in here.
We do.
Right. So let's actually dig into that a little bit more. Where's that coming from? I mean, why in this country versus other countries lack empowerment?
Right, good question. So the United States has a very strong individualist ethos. As a matter of fact, we're probably hyper-individualistic. And more or less, anybody who cannot take care of themselves is labeled in our society a deadbeat. Now, that's not my word. I'm just saying what society says about anybody who can't take care of themselves. That's how we label them. In other countries around the world, they have a much more collectivist model for taking care of people who can't take care of themselves. And in any society, whether we're talking about ours or a socialist system, there are always people who don't pull their weight. There always are in all societies. It's a certain percentage of people who do not pull their weight. But by and large, the vast majority of people who are unable to take care of themselves are elderly and children. That is the majority statistically in our country and around the world. However, we still have applied it to more or less everyone in this country. If you're not able to take care of yourself, well, too bad. You got to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. That's our mentality. And that's been fermenting over the last 100 years because of our personal development ethos. The prosperity doctrine was huge in influencing that. Ayn Rand was also huge in influencing that. Our politics has been huge in influencing that. That more or less is our mentality. So to counteract that, we really have to teach people empowerment. Empowerment is living a life of your design, and that is actually cultivating power. And power to a lot of people seems like a a swear word, like, you know, I don't want more power. I don't be power hungry. Here's what power actually means. Power is the ability to achieve intended results. That's it. The ability to achieve intended results. So no matter what you want to do, if you want to buy a bigger house, buy a bigger car, get a better job, those are all exercises in power. If you want to have another extra week of vacation and go off with your spouse on vacation, that is power. If you are immobile and have to use a walker to move around and you want to be mobile again, that is an exercise in power. So everything that you want that you don't currently have, even if you want to be able to read better or read more often or spend more time giving charity, everything is an exercise in power. And what I've discovered in most of the people who possess the least power is, by and large, they've given up even trying. So they don't have visions and dreams anymore for things they want. They've stopped even trying. They're usually just kind of living to live without even trying to transform. And that's the first challenge for us whenever we work with new people, is to get them thinking in the area of possibility again. What is possible for them? What could their life be like so they can even get inspired? Then we start to give them the tools so they can actually achieve the life by design.
Do you think everybody wants that? Everybody wants to get more power in their lives and they want to have these goals and dreams and ambitions and whatnot?
I don't think so. No, I think most people have kind of given up and resigned themselves to the lives they have. And they oftentimes create a kind of excuses around why their life is the way they have, and they don't want to move anymore. And it's very possible, by the way, that someone could be satisfied. No. The truth is that, you know, having more stuff, and sometimes I don't want to confuse power with amassing more things, because things really don't make us happier. The research is very, very clear on that. And if you were to spend $5 on buying a trinket or $5 giving it to somebody else, $5 giving it away to a homeless person will make you feel better than buying $5 for the stuff, or $50 or $100. Spending a $5,000 on a new couch or a new furniture, or spending $5,000 on a vacation, the $5,000 on a vacation will make you far more satisfied. Experiences are far better than things. But it's also possible that somebody has everything they need. Because really what satisfaction is about is a lot less about having, and it's a lot more about doing, and it's those 8 practices. And as long as you're doing those 8 practices and you have your basic necessities met, which means a roof over your head, food, health insurance, transportation, it actually is not about doing much more than that. So happiness is just about those practices I listed earlier.
So as you're on your journey and you're working on yourself, I mean, that's the whole idea of personal development. And you've gotten to this point, and we've talked a little bit about it indirectly, but I want to ask directly, what have been some of the most important lessons that you've learned along the way?
So much of personal development is about self-awareness and understanding how you are. Oftentimes life moves so quickly, it's hard for us to see our impact on other people. And we're unaware of the wake that we're creating as we're moving through the world. And that's been probably the most revealing part to me. I've got ADHD, and I also have what's called ODD, which is oppositional defiance disorder. So as a student, it was really hard for me sitting in classes. I had a hard time sitting in classes, and still do. I was also incredibly defiant of any kind of authority figures. I just wanted to say no matter what. I don't think I really became aware of those two things until I was probably in my 30s. I wish I had learned it in my teens, but it made school and my first jobs a heck of a lot easier versus just rebelling for the sake of rebellion. I wouldn't have known why. So that was a big part of my journey, was learning those things. Another big part of it was letting go of resentments. So I was abused as a kid, both physically and verbally. I carried huge resentments, which really, resentments are disempowering thoughts. thoughts. They really are. Resentments hold you back. They give you reasons why you can't be the best person you can be. They're emotional baggage, and they undercut who you can be. So the first part, first 5 or 10 years of my personal development was releasing my resentments, mainly toward my mom. I was so incredibly angry with her in my up until my 20s. Now I have nothing but compassion and love for my mother. I think it's next to impossible. This is a, well, I'll say I believe this. I can't say I can prove this. I believe this. It's really hard to be, if not impossible, to be a fully functional, mature adult if you are still harboring resentments toward either one of your parents. So that was a big part of my growth, was dispensing of all of that and getting to a place of compassion. And then also you kind of begin to learn about your leadership style. I was nicknamed by my brothers the Ramrodder, because I would ramrod through whatever I wanted, which caused a lot of resentment and a lot of pain. So a great deal of my development and my leadership style now is learning how to still have all of the drive to get things done. I got huge entrepreneurial drive. I've started 3 or 4 businesses, but doing it now in a way that still engenders cooperation versus engendering resentment.
So those are very powerful. And I want to touch on the resentment piece first, because clearly, I mean, I hear what you're saying, and but there's absolutely no way for me to fully understand the experiences that you had and what that was actually like to go through the process of releasing that resentment. So what was that actually like? I mean, what was the process of recognizing, wow, this is holding me back. This is not allowing me, or I'm not allowing myself to be the greatest version of myself because of this thing, this resentment. And what was that process of actually letting that go?
So at first you go through the intellectual exercise of understanding the power that resentment has over you. And most people, once they realize they've got a resentment, it doesn't take them long to realize that resentment has some degree of control over them, and it's usually a negative effect. The reason it's so important is because of in order to be have more power, in order to be more empowered, you have to have what's called, one of the first steps is absolute responsibility. Now, responsibility is about knowing who to blame, who's at fault for something. However, absolute responsibility is not that. So absolute responsibility is not the blaming part of it. Absolute responsibility is taking ownership of the situation as it is now. So I'm quite confident that I was not the one who abused me when I was a kid, verbally and physically. Very clear on that, not my fault. I was a kid. I just had to endure it and get through it. However, what I have absolute responsibility over is how I dealt with it. So when it was in my 20s and I was angry and hurt and emotionally volatile, I had to own that, the result of it, even though I didn't cause it. And until you can own the situation as it is, you cannot change it. So that's the first half of the intellectual exercise, is just to get to that spot where you realize that you have pain and anger. The other person who did it to you, or the situation, or the government, or the organization who caused that pain hurt, is not going to make it right. And almost every victim in the world realizes that they're not going to get the apology, probably. They're probably not going to get the apology. That person's probably not going to come back and, you know, pay for their therapy and make it right. It's probably not going to happen. It might. There are some, you know, some circumstances where it does, but it's probably not going to. And then once you are actually own the situation, you're empowered to change it. And there's all sorts of exercises that you can do, from journaling to going to therapists to personal development courses. There are some wonderful places around the world. The Meadows is out in Arizona. They do really great, we'll call it inner child work, which is what we're talking about here. We're talking about releasing resentments toward your parents. The Hoffman Institute, Northern California, is another one. We do some of it very lightly in Thrive Union, but we're educational more than therapeutic. But most likely organizations like that, if you've got deep-seated hurt and trauma, childhood trauma, those are the places you go.
So now that you have learned those lessons? And, you know, again, I was asking, what are the most important lessons that you have learned at this point? What questions do you still have about yourself?
Every once in a while, I'll learn a new topic. Like, you know, 5 years ago, I learned a lot about alcoholism and codependence. I don't have an issue with substances, but I took a deep dive into it to learn a lot about it, because most likely, if you have 10, you know, 10 people, one of them has an issue with a chemical dependence or alcohol. So I went and learned a lot about it. I kind of learned a lot about that. I learned a lot about codependence. I had some codependence behaviors. And I thought, gosh, I figured this one out. I'm no longer codependent. And that's the last thing about me that I need to learn. Then a couple of years goes by and I take another course. A couple of years ago, I went to the Almond Clinic out here in California, and they did a SPECT brain scan on me. I did that SPECT brain scan, and they came back. And what's really great with the Almond Clinic is they not only show you the physical structure of your brain, but they show how the physical structure of your brain actually creates your psychology. And then from that, I learned I had PTSD. Oh, that's why I have such a hard time regulating my anger and why anxiety is so incredibly bad for me. That's why I have memory issues. Believe it or not, the anxiety was causing memory issues as well. And then that was another thing for me to learn and take on. So, you know, there's no shortage of growth areas in life. The one that I'm working on now is on leadership. And as I run now a large volunteer corps, getting people to do things for the organization for their reasons is a never-ending challenge. And that's the one that I'm currently working on now. Plus, I'm a parent. That is every single day a new hurdle, every single day. There's not a day that goes by that my kids don't throw something at me that requires me to move like Neo in the Matrix and try to figure out how to handle it every single day. I have a wonderful, spectacular wife and a growing relationship. So there's always growth there. Oh, there's no shortage of things to learn and grow upon. No shortage. Every time I think I'm done, there's something new. Every single time. Every time.
I couldn't agree more. But that's kind of the fun of it, right? Yeah. I mean, we're never done.
Never done.
There's always a new challenge, a new something exciting to tackle and take on.
Couldn't agree more. So, you know, one of the most important, I've got a couple of master values. And the master values, which means they're operational values for me, that, you know, they're really important. And one of them is humility. My definition of humility is a little different than the textbook definition of humility. And humility is be able to look at yourself objectively and admit when you're wrong. And to me, humility is a master value because it's really hard to grow without it. So I am willing to look at myself, both the good and the bad, the strong and the weak, admit when I'm wrong. And I really believe the best measurement of humility is the speed at which you can admit you're wrong. And I want to admit I'm wrong instantly so I can apologize, reconcile the relationship, if there was an error in the relationship, and then make changes in myself so I improve. So that's a really important value for me.
So I'm so glad the conversation went this way, because I think about this a lot. Let's say you are in a situation where you may have done something, or, you know, maybe you didn't even realize you did something, but the other person took offense to it, or they got their feelings hurt or something like that. And you recognize now that they have their feelings hurt, but to you, it's like, but I really didn't do anything wrong.
Yeah.
But you know that it can be solved very quickly and easily if you just say I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. But like, it's almost like your tongue is glued to your mouth, to where you just can't get it out. You can't say it. What's going on there? What's all that about?
Oh, it's most likely pride is most likely what it is. And there's also an element of what we call boundary enforcement with that as well. So let me share with you a scenario that happened between me and my daughter. My daughter's 16 years old. She showed me a skirt, and I said the skirt was small. And it was small. It was physically small. That's all there was to it. It was small. And she got incredibly upset, and she said, I can't believe you said it to me. And I said, what? The skirt is small. She said, no, you called me a whore. I said, What?
What?
This is the mind of a 16-year-old girl. So clearly, I did not say that. Would never say that to anybody, ever. It's a horrible, terrible thing to say. And I was trying to explain it to her that I said, but she was still incredibly hurt. So what I then went into is I realized it was necessarily rational. And she's, you know, as her father, I'm in a figure in her life where she's looking for approval. And she saw my labeling of it as small as being some kind of judgment value versus just a descriptor on the spirit. And I pretty quickly realized that. So I really stopped. We're kind of moving around and stuff like that. I really stopped. I looked at her as she was kind of emoting a bit and stuff like that. And I went into empathy. And empathy is to care about the feelings of somebody else's more than your own, just for a minute. It really is to put yourself in their shoes. So where I could have gone, and I did go briefly, was, what are you talking about? You are insane. But that is completely not helpful in that scenario. Right. Just not helpful. So I went into empathy. I stopped. I put my feet on the ground. I looked at her and just really listened to what she had to say. I asked some more questions, and they weren't questions to make her wrong. They were just questions as she feels. And I said, you know, Piper, I'm really sorry if I made you feel that way. I absolutely positively would never put that label on you. I think you are the best kid in the world. And we were able to put it behind us. So I apologized more for how she felt rather than what I did. And that's how I didn't want her to feel justified in thinking that her father called her that awful word, but I didn't.
That's a great example. And so then as like a kind of a tangent, maybe not a tangent, but like to keep going with that, because I think this is really fascinating. What happens if the other person is, however, operating from a place of insecurity or unhealthy behavior? And let's say they then want an apology, and in some way it could be where, and I'm not sure if it is, but maybe that apology almost reinforces that unhealthy behavior.
Right.
And it's like, then you're giving up your power.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's like, it's almost like playing into that game. Yeah, you know, what's going on there? How do you unpack that one?
You're exactly right. So in that scenario, my daughter wanted me to vindicate this unhealthy thought that her father would demean her by calling her whore, which I wasn't. And so I want to validate that. So I am absolutely with you. The best solution in that scenario is to empathize and empathize longer. So it's to sit down with them, get them to lower their anxiety, and ask them lots and lots of questions so they can unpack it for themselves. But you can't do it in an argumentative way. If they are in an excited state where they are defending and angry, you will not get to the place where they can actually recognize and own their side of that conversation. So sometimes you have to say, okay, I'm really sorry you're feeling this way. Would you mind if we came back to it later tonight or tomorrow? I do want to talk about it more, but I got to go do some stuff right now. We'll come back to it later. And then later, what you want to do is unpack it enough through asking enough questions that they can come to own their side of the equation, where they can basically go, oh, you know, I guess I was really just tired. And I kind of felt hurt earlier when you didn't buy a mini milkshake. And, you know, the truth is, I know that you would never say that. That's what you want them to get to. But unfortunately, you telling them to say that doesn't work. Most people have got to come to that of their own accord.
Which can be very frustrating at times. And and I actually think where a lot of people get caught up, including myself, by the way, I'll be the first one to say it, is when that happens, getting into the spot of like, I didn't say that, or oh my God, how could you think that I think that, or you know, something, right. and then you start to get defensive, and then you know, you're both just kind of crying and nobody's actually talking or having any sort of communication. Yeah, that is
a doozy. Let me give you one more technique whenever you're receiving feedback. So whether it be someone's telling you about you or giving you feedback on something you did to them that you think there's misconstruing, is the mid analogy. So someone is talking at you and they're coming at you aggressively. Now, what you normally want to do, both verbally and also physically, is you want to try to defend. You're going to have a heightening state of anxiety. You're going to be like pushing back. You're going to kind of buttress against what they're saying. And my suggestion is don't do that. So first of all, recognize you don't have to defend yourself. That whatever their experience of you is their experience of you. And usually if you think that, well, I'm going to argue their point away and then they're going to like me more, that's not usually the case. Hearing them is going to make them like you more. So all you have to do is listen to what they say and imagine they just threw at you a baseball, a softball, and you've got a mitt. So you got your mitt and they threw a softball at you saying, well, I didn't like what you did and you don't really care about me. It's obvious. You take that, you put it in the mitt. And as soon as you put it in the mitt, you don't fire back. You just sit there with it just for a second and you look at it in your mitt. You go, huh, is that mine or is that theirs? Did I really do something that caused them pain and was out of lines or I violated a boundary? Or was it on their side? They misconstrued something that was actually pretty innocent on my side. Is this my issue or their, or maybe a little bit of both? But if it's not yours, rather than throwing it back, you just drop it. You don't have to own it. It's not yours. Just let it go. So I look at every single time that someone's directing something at me, I just catch it with the mitt and I sit with it a minute. And if it's mine, I'll own it and make changes to it and apologize to it. If it's not, I just let it go. The phrase I use in my mind, if someone's got an issue that's not really my problem, is not my monkey, not my circus. that's the phrase that makes me laugh and goes, I just go, you know what, that is, or that's not my pig, not my farm. That is not my issue and not my domain. That is theirs and I'm walking away. So those are the phrases that I use to help me not get engaged in arguments that I don't need to be in.
That's powerful. I feel like this is really, really important stuff. And on like a day-to-day basis level of like, this sort of technique and in these tools, because what we're talking about are really tools with which to go about and not only understand our own reality better, but also to be able to navigate it in a way that's the most beneficial for us, right? But like being able to impact somebody's day to day, that's huge. I really think we came away with a lot of wins here and a lot of really powerful ideas and concepts. So, I want to thank you very much, Peter, for that. And, I want to be very respectful of your time.
I just want to say that my spreadsheet I pulled paid off because all the ideas I gave you today were all ideas that I've accumulated over time and put on my spreadsheet. And once you kind of cement them onto a spreadsheet, they kind of get cemented in your mind as well. So which idea was better? Which was the better $1 million idea? How to overcome a conflict, or was it the spreadsheet idea for keeping all your content?
I think they're both very important. I think in different situations, they're going to be more or less valuable. I mean, as far as like day to day working with other people, dealing with other people, conflict resolution, man, that's the gold mine right there. But as far as like a lifelong pursuit of growth and learning and equipping yourself with more tools and ideas to better be able to handle all of life situations, spreadsheet.
Yeah, spreadsheet's good. I told you it was a good idea.
Good.
That's good.
Yeah, that's good.
So, I run a life school. That's what we do. And this is what a life school basically does is we give you practical tools and techniques so you can actually overcome the day-to-day challenges that you have. We share them when you interviews on podcasts like this. We have classes that we do. And then we've also got a YouTube channel, which we have 5-minute video essays on every different topic you can possibly imagine. And just like the content delivered here today, I try to deliver very practical, content-rich ideas on a regular basis. If you go to YouTube and search for Thrive Union, you will find our Life School page, and we have got videos on every topic you can possibly imagine.
I actually just listened to Metacognition this morning. So,
oh yeah,
if y'all are looking for one to get you started, that one's pretty fun. So I'd suggest checking that one out. Yeah, absolutely. But Peter, I do want to thank you very, very much for coming on the show today and having this conversation with me. It's been very special, very meaningful. So I just want to say thank you very much.
Thank you for having me, Ben. It was a great interview. Really enjoyed it.
Me too. I have one more question for you, then we'll wrap it on up. But what question should I be asking you that I just wouldn't think to ask?
I think you're asking, this is a good question. If you could wave a wand and place a thought or an idea or a change into every man, woman, and child on the planet, what would it be?
What would it be?
Oh, I'll tell you what, I'm going to ask you first. It's my question, so I get to ask it first.
One idea in everybody's mind. That's a really good question. I think it would be something centered around, you know what? I know what it is. I would truly wish that everybody on the planet could take more of a long-term approach to their lives and to everything that they're doing. And instead of, like, for example, take a long-term approach to your health. So make better health decisions for your life. Take a long-term approach to your finances. Like, start educating yourself, understand how finances work. Start, you know, saving and investing and building your income and start doing that earlier on, you know, emotionally, physically, intellectually, spiritually, relationally, all, you know, all the disciplines of life. Think about them in a very long term, with a very long term perspective, so that you don't do anything today that's going to come back to bite you later on. So you don't burn bridges today of people who could be, I mean, really important people in your life later on. I mean, I talk to so many people on a regular basis, and I'm so grateful for that. And one of the things that I hear most often is the things that were the what is most important at the end of life are the relationships, the deep, meaningful relationships that we have at the end of life. So instead of being at the end of life and wishing that we had done more relationship building, wishing we had put forth the extra effort, I wish people could have that realization now, really early on, and start taking that long-term approach to everything that they do, because I think it would lead to significantly happier and more intentional and just better lives for everybody. And when we're all living better lives and we're all happier, then there could be peace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that. What personal development basically does is it gets us out of the habit of reacting all the time to situations, which oftentimes create really bad habits for us and have really bad effects. So personal development gets us operating more in the prefrontal cortex, which is executive function, which is thinking about long-term consequences. So when you have an emphasis on personal development, personal growth, like you're suggesting, is people start doing behaviors every day that have better consequences over the long term. That's a great answer. I love that answer.
So what's yours?
I would instill the morality of fulfillment in every man, woman, and child on the planet. So rather than operating from a place of personal enrichment, I think it's a lot of people's morality in this country is around personal enrichment. So if it makes them money, it makes them happy, then it's good. And if it doesn't, it's bad. I would have people thinking about personal fulfillment. How could they live the most flourishing life possible without hindering or hurting anybody else? Would instill that thought in every person's mind on the planet.
And how did you come to that conclusion?
That fulfillment most likely is the very best moral concept.
Yeah.
I think that I kind of went through rationally and looking at all the moral constructs, whether it be a religious construct and what, you know, a deity may have said do and don't do. I've looked at the Constitution, which does a really good job for governing a country, but not governing people's lives, that is. We can look at the philosophy of personal enrichment, and we can certainly see what that's getting us right now, which is a country that is largely isolated from one another. We can't solve political problems. We can't even agree on what reality is. So the philosophy, the morality of personal enrichment is certainly not good. So I can't find a better one. When you look at what fulfillment is and flourishing is, and people living fulfilling lives, it's kind of hard to argue with a better lifestyle. So I'm still open All my beliefs are temporary pending new information, every single one of them. So that is my belief right now. That's the best moral construct. If someone's got a better one, I'm all for it. Let me hear what it is.
Me too. I would love to know. In fact, whenever anybody has an idea like that, I would love if y'all could either tweet it at us or comment on this or somehow let us know so we can talk about it, because that would be super interesting. So anyways, yeah. Peter, thank you so much. I am so grateful that you came on the show. To everybody who's watching and listening, I love y'all. Y'all rock. Y'all are the best. And I will see everybody on the next episode. Take care now.